everybody. Welcome to Digital Hammurabi. I am Megan Lewis, and today I have Dr. Pinar Durgan with me, who is very kindly agreed to talk to us about death and burial in the ancient Near East, which is a fascinating topic. So I'm sure we're going to have an excellent interview. And at the end, we're going to talk about a project that Pinar is running called Project Visiting Scholar. So that will also be very exciting. Pinar, hello, welcome.
Hi.
Can you tell everyone a bit about yourself and maybe how you got into the field?
Yeah, I'll definitely do that. But I think before I start, I want to acknowledge a couple of things. So I think the first thing is that, you know, as you all know, there are heartbreaking things happening in the areas that we love and study. So I just want to say, you know, I think we all hope that peace and justice will come to these areas really soon. But I just wanted to make that acknowledgement so that we're all aware of things that are happening right now, especially in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I am currently a fellow at the Met in the Ancient Near Eastern Art Department, but I'm not here to represent the museum or the department in any kind of capacity. So all the views are my own and my own research. So, you know, those are the disclaimers. to talk about how I got into the field, I guess I can blame my mom for it. She has always been interested in history. She's a nurse and by training, but she was interested in history and archaeology. She would always buy us these, you know, National Geographic documentaries and magazines. And I grew up just, you know, learning about ancient Egypt, mummies, tombs, mm-hmm. and maybe that's where the whole fascination with death comes from. I don't really know. I wish I knew. But I also grew up in a place called Antalya, which is on the southern coast of Turkey. And there are, you know, classical Roman antiquities everywhere. You go to the beach, there's an ancient harbor. There are ancient sites all over, you know, all around you. So I think just like growing up in that kind of environment also made me really interested in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's why I went into archaeology. And when I went to my first excavation, I worked in Bronze Age levels. In my second excavation, I was in an early Bronze Age kitchen or food preparation area. So I just fell in love with the Bronze Age, basically. So I'm going to talk a lot about the Bronze Age.
That is I hope everyone's fine. Okay. Oh, absolutely fine. Do you want to talk about how one goes about studying death and burial? Because that's not something we've talked a lot about before here. I'm a text person, so we mainly deal with text. And burial sites are absolutely fascinating, archaeologically speaking.
Yeah, definitely. And texts are a big part of studying death and burial, because in order to understand the archaeological evidence, sometimes you also need to know a little bit about how people think about death, how people feel about the afterlife or things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's definitely this, you know, it is important to kind of combine all those different approaches. Another thing that's important is art historical evidence, which mm-hmm. is something that I don't think people have looked at a lot, especially in the study of the ancient Near Eastern practices of death and burial. So I can talk a little bit about that.
Please,
as well.
Yeah.
I think the first thing I should start with is this, I don't know, this question or this argument that people have about Mesopotamian ideas about afterlife versus Egyptian ideas of afterlife, and how Egyptians seem more, I don't know, optimistic about death and afterlife, whereas the Mesopotamians are more pessimistic.
I feel like the Egyptian view is more, it seems like they put more thought into it.
Right. It seems like that. But I think the one thing that's common is that there is a lot of anxiety around not knowing what's mm-hmm. going to happen when you die. And the Egyptians, you know, try to cope with it in different ways. And the Mesopotamians are trying to cope with it in different ways. But I don't think there's like this like stark contrast of like optimistic and pessimistic. Mm-hmm. I think there's a bit of kind of bias that comes from the archaeological evidence as well. You know, from Egypt, we have tombs, pyramids, mummies, all these things that are associated with death. But mm-hmm. in Mesopotamia, I mean, archaeological evidence, it exists, but it's not, you know, in terms of quantity, it's not comparable to Egypt. But in Mesopotamia, I think we still have enough references made to these like ideas or perceptions of afterlife. You know, the Epic of Gilgamesh is one of the best stories about death and dying and this anxiety of, you know, that you're mortal mm-hmm. and that you die. So I think there is evidence, but they're just different. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a pessimistic versus optimistic view of death. I think everyone is afraid of death. I think we can all relate to that. There's a lot of anxiety of not knowing what's going to happen in the afterlife. And, you know, it's just a different kind of coping mechanism, I think. I guess some of the other things that I can talk about is what I see in terms of in different time periods, these like common things that happen over and over mm-hmm. with death and burial. So as I said, I mostly do the Bronze Age, but I also delve a little bit into Neolithic mortuary practices, and some of you may know these plastic skulls that we have from Jericho and other places, especially in the Levant or southeastern Anatolia. And if you look at these things, you know, this idea of continuing these connections with the people who are dead or your ancestors, basically, I think we see that over and over again across the history of the ancient Near East. I think people want to have these connections with the people who are dead, who are dead or who are gone, and that kind of takes away a little bit of the anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about the Kispum rituals, for instance, that we have later on in Mesopotamia, those also talk about how you should be taking care of the dead. You should go to their chapels, to their tombs, and leave offerings, say their name. And all of these things are kind of like, you know, you make sure that when you die, people will take care of you and they will give offerings so that you can have things in the afterlife. I think it's the same thing that happens like across cultures even and across time periods. And I see that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the Kispum ritual, for those who don't know, you basically go and pour out like libations and leave food offerings for the people who have died. The remembering is of paramount importance.
Same thing in Anatolia as well. So usually, you know, today when we think of burials, we always think of something like you put the body underground, you close them up, and it's done, right? Like, we don't really have these like interactions, basically, or like continuing relationships with the body itself or with the burial itself. But that was really not the case in the ancient world. I mean, people went back to cemeteries, they left things. So we have, for instance, in Anatolia, a couple of cemeteries, Middle Bronze Age or Late Bronze Age pottery found in early Bronze Age cemeteries. Mm-hmm. So people are coming back to these places, even if they don't remember exactly who's been buried there. And even within the same time period when these cemeteries are active, for instance, in the early Bronze Age, people come and open the burial and they put another person in the same burial. So there's this, you know, it's not, you know, you close the burial and it's done.
And you forget and you go away.
Yeah, exactly. So it is there. You see dead bodies, you see skeletons, you see, you know, human remains. So it's a little bit more like an active relationship compared to what we have today.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Related to that, maybe, is the location of burials and cemetery sites. Do they tend to be closer to domestic architecture or within, like, more within the city limits than we might see in modern cemeteries, which are very often away and secluded somewhere?
So in the Neolithic period, I think across the ancient Near East, we can say that the like main way of burying the dead was to bury them intramurally, which means either underneath your house, for instance, at Çatalhöyük, which is a central Anatolian site. They have all these platforms, and underneath them, we have burials. So people would be usually buried within the houses or within the settlement, but that's starts to change around 3000 BC in Anatolia, for instance. So people start to bury their deceased outside of their settlements. They're not far, far away. Usually they're, you know, between 300 meters and like the furthest, I think, is like 700 meters. Mm-hmm. So you can still probably see from your settlement where the cemetery is. Mm-hmm. But they are kind of separated from the living areas. It doesn't happen everywhere. For instance, there are some sites where kind of the settlement and the cemetery kind of interchanges over time. So sometimes they're using the cemetery, or like they're building buildings over the cemetery, and then the settlement shifts and then the older place becomes the cemetery. So there's this, you know, there's really no separation, I think, conceptually, that it is like a completely different place.
I don't normally do this, but drawing parallels with modern living, the idea of building a domestic structure or even building anything over a graveyard is very uncomfortable and very, very taboo. But it's interesting that there isn't that separation in the ancient world.
Yeah. Especially, you know, when you talk about the Neolithic, people always seem a little bit shocked that there would be, you know, dead bodies underneath where you're living, basically, your day-to-day life. But it is, I don't know, everyone asked me about, you know, wouldn't it smell? Wouldn't it smell bad? And I don't really know if, you know, the smell would actually come out, because most of these places, especially in Çatalhöyük, they're plastered over once, you know, you close the burial. So I don't know if it would smell. I really have no idea. Someone should do some sort of, you know, experimental archaeology with this. But there is really this idea of burying people underneath houses doesn't really go away even after the emergence of extramural cemeteries. So we still have babies and young women still being buried within the settlements, even when they have an extramural cemetery. And in Mesopotamia, the intramural burial is a more common practice, or at least we know more about those than the traditional cemeteries. For instance, in the old Babylonian period, we have these like family chapels almost, mm-hmm. kind of connected to houses. So this idea that the dead are kind of in your living space is not really a shocking or like a uncommon thing mm-hmm. that happens. But yeah, to us, because especially I think in this like the Western culture or in American culture, it's a little bit of a weird thing to have any kind of connection with dead bodies or dead yeah. things. You kind of want to, you know, stay away from it. But yeah, it wasn't really the case in Shinnerie East. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Thank you. What kinds of ways, apart from the location, were there lots of different ways in which people were buried? So massive yeah. jars, that's yeah, definitely so, not a leading question.
No, it definitely is not, right? It's actually one of my favorite questions because I love pitos burial. So the pitoi are these large storage jars. So they are usually used for storage, like grain storage and things like that in the settlements. Mm-hmm. But we see them very commonly in especially early Bronze Age and Middle Bronze Age cemeteries in Anatolia. And when they appear in different parts of the ancient Near East, usually scholars have referred to them as like the Anatolian type of burial. I don't know if there's some sort of like ethnic or cultural connection to it, but they're very common, especially in Western and Central Anatolia. Mm-hmm. And we see them, you know, across the Bronze Age. It's not a tradition that just comes and goes. It really continues for long periods of time. And I think what makes them a little bit even more interesting is that they are used as these burial containers. Some of them have only one individual, but in a lot of cases, we see multiple individuals interned into them. Mm-hmm. So they usually bury the pitos burials kind of like in an angle. So it's easier to open them and put another person in it. And that's another good experimental archaeology question, I think. How do you put body?
How do you put a person in a massive jar?
Yeah. And in the jar, like usually the openings are not, you know, huge. They are big, but they're not, you know, you wouldn't comfortably mm-hmm. slide a person into the pot. So that's on my list of things to do. Someone has to put me in a pitos jar. You know, we have to just try it out. But yeah, so pitos burials are common. I mean, jar burials are also another thing that we see across the Mediterranean and also the ancient Near East. Mm. And babies and infants are usually put in these like smaller jars. So I don't know if the idea starts there and then later on, you know, adults are also buried in pitos jars. Mm. It's possible. But yeah, so pitos jars are like, I think they're amazing because usually people usually refer to them as like burials for ordinary people because they're jars, right? But I think that's a little bit misleading because making a jar like that will take a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And also then you have to carry the jar from wherever it's made to the settlement or to the cemetery, which is also not an easy thing. They can go up to 2 meters. So, you know, when you look at excavation pictures, you can see at least like 5-6 people are needed to lift one of these things. Mm-hmm. So that also adds to this like kind of communal aspect of burial practices. You have to do it together with other people. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes them even more interesting to me, at least.
Is there anything distinguishing the burial pitos jars from the jars that would be used for storage? Is it, or are they probably just made by the same people and used for different purposes?
That's a good question. So some of them, I think the ones from Karataş, which is actually really close to my hometown, Antalya, they have found pitos jars that had some, you know, wear and tear. So they weren't like brand new jars, but I don't really know if there's any kind of, you know, I don't know how we would know if they were actually like specifically made for mm-hmm. the burial. And then like, you just like keep them in your house, use them for storage. And then when you die, you're buried. Dies, yeah. Or, you know, you just use the one that's not being used. Like, I don't really know, but I think that's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And some of these pitoi can have like decorations or some images even of animals or plants and things like that. They're not very common, but they do exist. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know if there's an idea of, you know, you take your pitos with you. But that would be great to, you know, find out somehow.
That would be interesting. Kind of like yeah. the slightly morbid version of a hope chest. You're given yeah. one as a yeah. child and you just keep it. And then yeah. when you need it, it's there. So could you maybe, and again, this is tricky just going on archaeological evidence. So obviously there's going to be textual information in here as well. Could you maybe speak a little bit about beliefs, afterlife beliefs?
Yeah, definitely. So for Anatolia, unfortunately, we don't really have that kind of like text that explains what happens in the afterlife or, you know, the gods of the afterlife. And the main texts that we have from Anatolia are the Hittite royal funerary ritual texts that I talked about in the At the Margins conference. So they basically lay out the process of the ritual if a king or a queen dies. Mm-hmm. So they say, on the first day we do this, on the second day we do this. Unfortunately, we don't have the last day really, so we don't know like how they bury, like how the ritual ends. But in Mesopotamia, we actually have more texts that talk about this idea of the afterlife, like how it is, or like how it's like once you die. Mm-hmm. And I think these ideas about like this pessimistic view come from these texts mainly, because they talk about, you know, it's a place that it's dark, there's no light, you eat clay for food, you drink mud for, you know, your water. So it's a little bit of a sad place to be. But I think like part of that is that because you don't know what's going to happen. So again, this like anxiety, that like if your children or if generations coming after you don't give you these, you know, this kisbum rituals, they don't give you offerings, then you will have to eat clay and you have to drink mud. So it is important that you have, you know, sons and daughters who would take care of you once you're dead. And you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh kind of talks about this idea. We also have Death of Unamo, where they kind of line out the objects, for instance, that you should take with you in order to give all the gods when you're passing to the afterlife. We have some administrative texts that kind of talk about the types of burial objects. There's, of course, you know, Ereshkigal and Nergal, the myth about the goddess of the underworld, the descent of Ishtar or Inanna mm-hmm. to the underworld. So we see these ideas of, you know, the underworld is literally, you know,
underneath.
And then you have to pass these seven gates to get there. And the gates are not really, you know, to keep out the living, but to keep in the ones who are
underneath. Dead. Yeah.
Because you don't want them to come back as ghosts and, you know, bother the living. So for instance, when Ishtar goes down, she has to take off all her jewelry, all of her clothing. So you basically go there as kind of stripped off your living power or your energy, whatever that is. And then I think there's a section about Gilgamesh and Enkidu, and Enkidu goes to the underworld to you know, fetch the ball or whatever, escapes into the underworld, and Gilgamesh warns him to not wear shoes, for instance, or to not have clean clothes, or smell with like oils, like good smelling oils, because apparently those things are things that they associate with dead people. Mm-hmm. So there are these like, you know, small snippets of ideas how the underworld looks like, or what you should be doing if you're passing through, or what you should not be doing if you don't want to be going into the underworld. Mm-hmm. So there are all these like religious ideas and myths or literary pieces like the Traveler and the Maiden, which talks about this woman who's preparing for her lover's return. But as the text goes on, we kind of realize that the lover is actually dead. Mm-hmm. So she does all these rituals around his dead body, cleans him and anoints his body with oils. So we get a little bit of an idea of, you know, what is the religious idea kind of surrounding what you should be doing when someone dies. Mm-hmm. And again, the kisbum rituals kind of tell you, like, you should do these things because they will need things.
They need food and they need, yeah. Excellent. Thank you. What do you think of the idea that jar burial is a form of rebirth? So envisioning the jar as a womb.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I don't think we can say for sure that there was an idea like that, because we don't really have the text to tell us any kind of ideas about death and afterlife. Mm-hmm. But I think it makes sense just because, you know, the shape of the jar is very humanoid. And in some cases, we actually do see some jars that have, you know, like eyes on the neck, or the handles kind of look like arms. There are even jars, they're not burial jars, but they're just jars used in general in the settlements. And they have, you know, pubic triangles or breasts kind of incised onto mm-hmm. them. But I think there is this idea that pots kind of look like people, which is not that far-fetched, because as archaeologists, we refer to them as, you know, the neck of the mm-hmm. of the pot, or the, you
like
know,
the shoulders.
And, yeah, the shoulders, yeah. Or the lip of the rim. So it could be, you know, that could be one of the reasons why they like that type of burial. But then the question is, you know, we also have burials that are just simply just, you know, simple inhumation. So basically buried in a pit, mm-hmm. or these burials that are buried in a pit, but then surrounded by stones. So do those have different kind of ideas about afterlife? If we, you know, agree that this is actually like the human body. It's kind of like a rebirth, going back into the womb or something like that. Then what do these other ones tell us? I don't really know if there's like, you know, a way that we can find out, but I think it's a great idea. It could be some sort of association with giving birth or like going back into, you know, earth or the womb, which could be represented by the titles. Yeah, that's a good question.
Thank you. I was also thinking as you were talking earlier that my initial thought of jar burials was that's really odd, but in a region where actually timber can be hard to come by and expensive, and clay is somewhat in abundance, if you need a container for burial, you're not necessarily going to build a casket like Western cultures would.
Yeah.
So make a giant pot. Why not?
Yeah. But also, you know, making a giant pot is not easy.
Not easy. Yes, true.
You know, like you can just bury someone in the ground and they do that too. But then there are these jar burials, which, and in some cases they even build little like stone walls that are kind of like the burial is inset into the wall. Mm-hmm. So they are going out of their way to like make these, which I think are elaborate burials instead of compare it to just burying someone in a pit. So there must be some sort of, you know, ideological.
There's a reason behind it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I wish
but
I knew.
What it is, you mentioned saying the name of the dead as part of a ritual. I'm wondering if there's a connection to Egypt, because that's a very central thing in Egyptian death beliefs.
I mean, there could be definitely a, you know, similar idea. And we look at these cultures as like separate things, but in some cases there are similarities. And it could be just, you know, because of contact, but it could also just be a human thing, right? Like we all bury our dead. We all get sad. We all mourn for our dead. Mm-hmm. So these like similarities don't really surprise me, or it doesn't really raise the question, you know, like, does it come from here or does it come from here? It's a natural reaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, think about looking at pictures of your dead grandparents or something like that. Like, we do want to keep these memories of the people. So I think just saying their name is just a part of that. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, we have the same thing in Egypt as well. So I don't know if it's a result of contact or if it's just you know,
human nature.
Yeah, it could be just human nature.
Thank you. Would you say that there is an early conception of improper burial resulting in wandering ghosts?
I can speak for Anatolian burials. So it seems like they don't really care about that. So there is a lot of, as I said, when they enter a second body into the Pitos burial, they kind of push aside the older bones and the skeleton. So we have usually these like jumbles of bones in these Pitos burials. They don't really lay them down nicely. Because you can't really do that in a Pitos burial, right? The body will slip, it will move. And if you're adding more people, you will have to end up with these jumbles of bones. So I don't think they are actually thinking about keeping the integrity of the body itself. And they also move around bodies. So we have burials where, you know, you have a missing leg, and then you have another burial where you just have the skull, for instance. So I don't think that's it's a worry that, especially, you know, for my case in Anatolia, that people have. When I talked about cremation, I think I kind of hinted at that as well. They don't really see this division between cremated bodies and inhumated bodies. So you can mix, you know, burned body parts with an inhumated burial. They don't really see that kind of difference. At least it's not expressed materially.
Building on the previous question, do you have any like thoughts on vampires and other undead monsters?
Interesting.
Yep.
I never thought about ancient vampires. That's a great question. Someone should write like a novel about this because I'm not going to. But I don't know if there's any kind of, you know, like fear around dead bodies in Anatolia. I mean, there's definitely this, you know, this idea of ghosts coming back in Mesopotamia. And I think at some point in the Epic of Gilgamesh, Ishtar gets angry and she kind of threatens people that, you know, she will call all the dead to devour
the living. Yeah.
But I don't know anything like that in Anatolia. I don't know if they like do anything to keep the dead in where they are. Mm-hmm. They close the mouths of the Pitos jars, and they close burials, right? Like burials are closed constructions, but they can be reopened. But because they're reopening it, I feel like probably not. They're probably not afraid of, you know, something happening when they open the burial, because otherwise they wouldn't be adding more people into the same jar. They would open another pit, or they would bring another jar into mm-hmm. the cemetery. And that's just my speculation. Yeah.
The practice of inhuming bodies within domestic structures as well would, if you're worried that the bodies are going to get up and do something, you probably wouldn't put them under your kitchen.
Yeah.
You'd have them away. But yeah, that's my speculation. I have absolutely no idea.
But I mean, there are, you know, because I lived in New England for so long, if you're interested in like historical vampires, you should definitely look into like New England burials and vampires. They do things with bodies.
Oh, so interesting.
That's like vampires. Yeah.
Oh, I will have to look into that because I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about grave goods?
Yes.
And what people are buried with, because that is interesting for me.
I think this is my personal, not complaint, but I kind of don't like this like emphasis on burial objects mm-hmm. that much, because I think we try to put so much meaning into what these objects like mean about the person, about their identity, or about their social class in life, that I think we kind of sometimes miss the point about why they're there. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to differentiate between burial objects that are left for the person to use in the afterlife, or left there because, you know, they have to give these things to the gods, as we hear from, you know, textual sources, or they're left there because people are visiting the burial and they're doing some mortuary rituals and there's some libation going on, or they're, you know, leaving offerings. So it's really difficult to distinguish those things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the question is, a lot of people use these things to talk about, you know, this person was a higher class than this person because they have, you know, metal jewelry and they have 5 pots instead of 1 pot or no pots. So I think those things are kind of our, what's the right word? We kind of just like project our expectations onto the archaeological evidence. Mm-hmm. And I think we should be a little bit more careful about associating burial objects with what it means for this person's identity.
I think one of the most interesting things I've really ever been told by a professor is burial goods tell you far more about the people who did the burial than the person who was actually buried. And I had absolutely never thought about it like that. And it is entirely correct.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's kind of like a cliche thing to say in mortuary archaeology, mm-hmm. the dead don't bury themselves, right? And maybe, you know, you bury them because they like this specific cup, or maybe you bury them because you think they will need this cup. Mm-hmm. Or they told you, you know, when I die, bury me with
this cup. Yep.
Yeah. And even though like maybe there's no like religious idea or cultural idea, maybe they just wanted that. And then you kind of have to do it. Mm-hmm. So, and then there are also, you know, we know from, for instance, ethnographic examples that sometimes people create these imagined identities for the dead person. And they kind of establish that with burial objects. But that doesn't mean that they were that person when they were living. I don't really agree with these, you know, associations between, you know, these like chiefly burials or warrior burials, or I don't know, like princess burials, and then they turn out to be males. Mm-hmm. You know, like all these associations seems a little bit artificial to me. Mm-hmm. Unless you have, you know, a good reason to assume that this belonged to this person because there is a seal with their name on it or something like that. But yeah, burial objects are a little bit tricky, I think. And if you look at, you know, what we find in burials across the ancient Near East, it's usually similar types of objects. We see pottery, especially, you know, like drinking vessels, serving vessels, or things that you would use to pour things. There's jewelry, like personal ornaments, or things like, you know, weapons like daggers or mace heads and things like that. But there's a really interesting study that came from Anatolian early Bronze Age objects. And they did this study on the metallurgy itself, so the metal objects mm-hmm. that were coming from these burials. And they figured out that the actual, like, the alloy, the copper alloy, was not, like, a strong alloy. So you wouldn't be able to use any of these objects for their intended purpose. So it's possible that these objects were just made
specifically for burial, like the, going back to Egypt again, like the Egyptian like models of plows and things.
Yeah, something like that. Or I talked in my talk a little bit about this, you know, you break objects, you bend them, you crush them. So if you want to do that, you probably need a softer alloy mm-hmm. because, you know, it will be really hard to put a bronze, you know, cup and then bend it. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that people are making things just for the purpose of the burial itself.
Very interesting. Thank you. Any ideas on the relatedness of funerary practices and ancestor worship being the root of human religion and cult practice? So, that is a big question.
It is a big question. So I'm trying to think of like good examples. So maybe we can go back to the Neolithic plastered skulls. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have called them, you know, ancestor cults because they basically wait for the body to decompose and then take the skull and then use clay to kind of reconstruct these like facial features. So they add a nose, they add cheeks, and they add ears. And then in some cases they paint them, they put, you know, shells as the eyes. So they're trying to recreate this image of a living person on these, you know, skulls basically. Mm-hmm. And it is possible that, you know, you want to keep an image of the deceased person with you or like for the community, because they don't have, you know, photographs like we have. So you want to keep some sort of like idea of this deceased person. And some people have argued that, you know, after generations, the people probably don't know exactly who this person is anymore, but it is an ancestor and it is an important part of their identity. Mm-hmm. It's possible that, you know, the reasons why you have these like interactions that we have in the Bronze Age with dead bodies connects to this idea of, you know, we continue these bonds with the people who are gone. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the origin. I mean, the origin may also well be, you know, keeping bodies away from animals and from scavengers and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we don't really know exactly why it started or how it started. But yeah, there are these, you know, early Neanderthal burials, for instance, from ancient Near East. And one of them was very interesting because at the time, I think it was found in the 70s. It's called the flower burial. So they found some, you know, remains of plants and things like that. And some people have argued that this was an evidence to show that the Neanderthals had these symbolic, you know, practices, mm-hmm. which was not really expected from Neanderthals in the 70s. I mean, now we know that they're very closely related to humans and, you know, they did symbolic practices. They did jewelry, they made jewelry and they had burials. But at that point, it was a shocking revelation that Neanderthals would bury their dead.
Yeah.
You know, things like flowers and things like that. Yeah.
Thank you. Are there any hints at personal burial goods like dolls for children or things that are more individual in nature? And is there even a way to determine this?
That's a good question. I think seals could be maybe, I mean, it's also possible that you have someone else's seal or you bury someone else's seal with this person. I think unless we find like a marked burial with the person's name and then marked objects with like same person.
Name, yeah.
It's really difficult. Mm-hmm. And also, again, because they're going back to these burial sites and opening burials and putting another person, it's possible that that object was intended to this person instead of this other person who was buried there. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult to find out those things. And in some cases, you know, people have tried to associate, for instance, animal sacrifices that exist in a cemetery with certain burials. Mm-hmm. But even in those cases, is it a sacrifice for all the dead people? Is it a sacrifice specifically for that person or for that burial? Mm-hmm. Like a family burial? We don't really know. So those kinds of questions, I think, are harder to answer without text.
Identity is really, it's such a difficult thing to get at
without
being able to actually just jump in a time machine and go back and have a conversation with someone.
Yeah, it's definitely. And I think burials are kind of seen as this kind of like black box where you just like seal the identity and like when you find it, oh, this is the person and this is all their objects. But it's really not like that. It's way more complicated. Yeah.
One more question. Are there any common features in the burials you've studied that indicate awarenesses of the possibility of ghosts and means within the burial to prevent them from bothering people?
In Anatolia, that's a good question. I don't really know about Hittite texts that talk about ghosts. Mm. I have to ask other Hittitologists who know the text better than I do. But in terms of the archaeological evidence, I don't know what you would find.
A big sign like Ghostbusters have.
Right.
Or just like, say no ghosts.
Yeah. I don't know what the, I mean, maybe we do have it, but we just don't know how that would look like. So we don't know how to interpret, you know, certain objects or certain setup of objects or something like that. It's possible that we do have those, but I don't really know.
Don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be fascinating if we could work it out. That would be very interesting, but exactly how we do that.
I don't know.
So many mysteries today.
Yeah, it is so many mysteries. And I don't know if all the ghosts in Mesopotamian texts, like they talk about these bad ghosts, but I don't know if all the ghosts
are bad necessarily. Are bad,
right?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I haven't done masses of research into ghosts. I should now. But my general sense is that ghosts are people who have not fulfilled their social obligations or have been stopped from fulfilling social obligations. So like the Lilitu ghost is women who died young and weren't able to marry and have children. So it doesn't seem like there was a fear of just general people becoming ghosts, but yeah. There was like a specific trigger maybe for ghost creation.
Or if you're not doing your part and not doing the things that you should be giving to that, maybe then...
Maybe they'll come and...
Yeah. But in Anatolia, I don't really know. I should look into this. Yeah, this is a good idea.
Would you like to take a few minutes and talk about Project Visiting Scholar?
Oh, yeah. I would love to talk about Project Visiting Scholar. So a couple of years ago, I started this database project, which is really as simple as that. It's a database where you can sign up to be a host, to host students or early career scholars or, you know, scholars with low income, for instance, who are planning to go to a conference, but they don't have the means to pay for a hotel, for instance, mm-hmm. right? Because going to an academic conference is really expensive. And if you're, you know, adjuncting, if you're a student, if you're a researcher with limited funds, you don't really, you know, you can't really go, but you are the person who really needs to go because you need to establish these networks. Mm-hmm. You need to present your research so that people know about your research. So I thought it could be maybe a helpful thing to do to have this database where you can look up, okay, let's say I'm going to Chicago. I'm going to look up who is a host in Chicago and then just email them and ask them if they're available and just stay in their guest room for like 3 days instead of paying for a hotel, which can get really expensive if you don't have the means. So it started as that. And then I think one of the things that I realized was that academic conferences are also very exclusionary, for lack of a better word. So I wanted to, you know, do something about making conferences more accessible, more inclusive. Mm-hmm. So I created actually recently this checklist where you can basically check off things to make your conference more accessible and inclusive. And they're really basic things that I don't think anyone should have even made a checklist. I don't think I should have, you know.
You shouldn't have to do it, yeah, but it needs saying.
As simple as, you know, having gender-neutral bathrooms, having wheelchair chair access, having, you know, a room where people can breastfeed or pray if they need to, or if they just need like a quiet room for take a break to do that. So those are really simple things that anyone can do if they're organizing a conference. But I think it's just like a reminder that, you know, if you're worried that you're going to forget something, just make sure
there's a checklist so you can just go through it and say, yes, we remember to do all of these things. Oh, yeah, look, exactly. We don't have spaces available for wheelchair users. Maybe we should do that.
Yeah, exactly. So the website I have for Project Visiting Scholar right now is a temporary one. It's not really the database. I have a database information. So if anyone wants to use that, so if you're planning to go to a conference and you don't have a place to stay, you don't have the funds, then send me an email and I'll try to put you in touch with someone in the area and you can ask them if you can stay with them. Hopefully soon we will have our actual database website online. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of legal things we needed to do. For instance, we want to have a sexual harassment policy because you're going to go stay with this person that you probably don't know. And this other person is going to come stay with you that you probably don't know. Mm-hmm. So we want to protect everyone who's involved in the situation. So we're working on a couple of legal issues, but hopefully soon it will be live and then you can just, you know, there will be a map. You can just like click on wherever you're going and then it will give you the list of people who signed up to be hosts. And on that website, I'll send you a link and you
please
follow up. You can sign up to be a host as well if you think you have, you know, a guest room and you're happy to have other academics over. It's also a great way of networking, right? You're going to meet, it's not just for the ancient world disciplines. It's open to everyone. I have about, you know, more than 200 hosts from about like 20 different countries. If you're going to Norway, there is someone who signed up to be a host. So you can sign up as well and help other academics go to conferences.
Fantastic. It's a very, very important, very worthwhile project. And you have a travel grant as well, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, so we gave our first travel grant this year to the At the Margins conference. We were happy to have a student who didn't really have any kind of institutional support to come and attend the conference. That's the other thing. When you don't present at a conference, you usually don't get funds from your institution. So if you're in that situation and something that's really connected to your research, what do you do, right?
You've got to pay for it yourself. And
exactly. So we started to give out a travel grant. And this one was just, it worked out with the At the Margins conference, but the project is just me, my sister, and a friend who does the website design. Mm-hmm. So if anyone wants to help us out and, you know, help kind of build this travel grant money so that we can give it to students and early career scholars who need it. We don't have a donation button or anything right now, but Megan kindly offered that you can make your donation to Digital Hammurabi and they will help us out later on once we have the donation button.
So if you want to help Pinar get together money to ensure that students, early career scholars, those on limited incomes can attend professional conferences, and I cannot emphasize this enough, these are essential for building a career. If you want to be an academic, not going to conferences is just not an option. So if you want to help her make sure that those who can't afford to go by themselves have some kind of resource, please send us a donation. You can send it to our PayPal, which is digitalhammurabi@gmail.com. In the, like, there's a little note section, please put for Project Visiting Scholar. I will put it aside. And as soon as Pinar has an account that I can pay the money into, it will be sent over to her. So thank you in advance.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
that would be very, very helpful. Final question. How do we reach you to sign up for Visiting Scholar or ask questions?
For Project Visiting Scholar, there's a website so that there is like a, you know, contact me kind of tab that you can just send me an email. There's my email on that website as well. Project Visiting Scholar is on Twitter. So if you just search for Project Visiting Scholar, you can find us. And I usually try to update it with, you know, conferences that get certified for completing all the checklists, or if we have a travel grant, I announce it there as well. So Twitter is probably a good place to look at, and our website, our temporary website, is a good place. And I also, you know, if you're in New York and if you want to talk about death, I'm at the Met, so send me an email and I would love to have, you know, coffee or tea and talk about deaf people and ghosts. But if you are interested, I am at the museum, so send me an email.
Thank you very much. Is there anything you want to add to this very long and varied conversation?
Not really. I think just talking about death, it kind of helps us to see our own anxieties about death as well. You know, the kinds of questions that we have about ancient people, like how they bury dead or like how they think about the afterlife. So I think it gives us a chance to reflect on what we do today as a society, to how we treat our dead. So if you're interested, there are these really great resources about this positive death movement, the Order of Good Death. And they have blogs, they have podcasts, and they talk about how we shouldn't be treating death as like a taboo topic, and we should be talking about it. We should, you know, kind of prepare ourselves for the death of ourselves or, you know, people around us. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested, there are lots of resources about that out there as well.
Thank you. I will put some of those links, in the description, and I will follow those up myself, because that actually sounds fascinating. Thank you, Pinar, for making time.
Yeah, it was a
really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, of course. Everyone, until next time, resist poor scholarship. Always ask, how do you know that?